You are listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource, and we are grateful to all of our listeners who help keep us the podcast going by donating to the show. We are also grateful and proud to be supported by the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies.
Welcome to episode 63, where we are discussing the topics of remote work and leading at a distance using the Hudson's Bay Company of 17th through 19th century London and Canada as a case study. This is part one of the episode, which we've subtitled A Historical Look at a Present-Day Challenge. We will be using a book chapter by O'Leary, Orlikowski, and Yates from 2002, titled Distributed Work Over the Centuries, Trust and Control in the Hudson's Bay Company, 1670 to 1826, from the book Distributed Work, edited by Hines and Keisler. This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
This is Dimitris calling in from Kuldīga in Latvia.
And this is Greta calling in from Oxford, UK.
And this is Frithjof calling in from beautiful Delft.
Welcome, everybody.
Hey, hey, hey. How are you all doing?
So I presume that the four of us are each heavily involved in remote operations at this point?
Yes.
Well, that's one way to put it, yeah.
One way to put it. So I guess it's a perfect time to have a discussion about remote work and remote operations. And today we're going to look at a historical example using the Hudson's Bay Company. And we have a couple of articles that we're going to look at. The first one's a book chapter by Michael O'Leary, Wanda Orlikowski, and Joanne Yates titled Distributed Work Over the Centuries, Trust and Control in the Hudson's Bay Company, 1670 to 1826. And I'd like to turn it over to Greta, if you would, to give us a quick introduction to this.
Maybe before we get all work and no fun, I suppose, how are you doing with the current situation?
Okay. How am I doing with the current situation? Making do. I mean, we've transitioned all of our resident classes to distance, and we're going through some technical challenges trying to make it work. The transition is hard. It takes a lot of time and effort, and a lot of getting used to dealing with. We're using a virtual world, and it's interesting when you're used to dealing face to face, and now you're dealing with avatars. And it creates a whole different dynamic.
Yeah, I'm finding myself struggling with the amount of virtual meetings and all the Zoom and all the Skype. Somehow, it's more draining than being in actual face-to-face meetings.
Right.
So that's not great. And then the whole thing with the people needing to follow the rules and them not doing that is unnerving.
Yeah, and that part of it is, too, is you feel like the day gets sort of stretched out because you're accustomed to being able to walk to the next door office or to be able to go to the secretary or do a lot of those sorts of ordinary routine communications that are very efficient. Now that you're sort of dealing with being beeped at by notifications at all times during the day, and it's harder to prioritize. For me, it just took a little bit of getting used to, and everybody in my department was kind of in the same boat.
Are any of us teaching at the moment?
Yeah, I am. Well, it is challenging. Now, I'm kind of lucky that I'm not teaching like core material anymore. These are electives, so I'm dealing with students who chose to be in the class. So there's a certain motivation factor that's easy to translate, and also because the students were resident for a period of time, then we kind of already have some protocols established for conducting class that are embedded that it's just a matter of getting used to. Now, it would be different. Let's say that this carries over, you know, heaven forbid, this carries over into the next class or to the next cohort, and we have to start in a virtual environment as opposed to having a resident startup point. That would be a much, much different challenge, and it's something that we're thinking about already because none of us knows at this point how long this is going to carry on. And so we got to have these kind of conversations. How do you welcome a class into a distance environment with the expectation that we hope we can turn to resident later?
I can totally imagine those challenges you're facing, Tom. A few weeks ago, we had Tamar Zilber visiting us at Said Business School, and she already for a few years offers a course online. And during the dinner I had with her, she pointed out how the attention span when you're teaching online is so different from when you're doing face-to-face in-class teaching. And she mentioned that, you know, usually the attention span in a remote setup is about 7 to 8 minutes.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's a completely different way that we as teachers have to engage with our students than we're used to. So much novelty we're facing.
That's an important point. At my previous institution, I was designing some distance learning stuff just as a matter of course, mainly as an outcome of being on this podcast. And anything that wasn't short increments was just dysfunctional. Students don't take that stuff in through that medium. So if you're out there and you need to design asynchronous learning, you know, make sure to keep it brief and on point for each of the topics that you're covering.
Yeah, and another dynamic that's different is that I found that students tend to talk transactionally with me as the instructor more than, say, in a traditional seminar kind of a setting where everybody is around at the table and they're talking to each other and I'm more of a facilitator. It's sort of, I don't want to say devolved, but it has shifted to much more of I'm directing traffic, making sure that, you know, what's the order of sequence of students talking. And it's less efficient, and it also kind of it changes the conversational tone. I mean, you don't get the same richness necessarily of conversation as you would if you were all physically sitting around the table.
Well, it's the scientific management for education. It shifts the relations from many to one to one to one.
But do you see any advantages?
Well, yes, there are some advantages. And I think over time, we'll really understand the advantages and disadvantages. Some of the advantages are that we can cover a lot of ground pretty efficiently, and we don't have the same level of distraction inside the building. You know, like we don't have the same level of meetings or conferences or administrivia that we ordinarily would expect to deal with if we were physically in the building. So I actually find that I can control my preparation time a little bit better, and I think the students at least have that. The downside is because this isn't ordinary remote operations, folks are at home, you know, the students are at home with their families who are not going, you know, the kids aren't going to school or any of that. We have to assume that their ability to prepare is impacted. And so we change the coursework to try to make it as, you know, we want to make sure that we get the most out of those 3 hours that we spend with them for our typical seminar, and not make too many assumptions about about their ability to prepare outside. So I've been trying to make my classes a little bit more self-contained than perhaps I would ordinarily otherwise.
One observation from my end, as you know, I recently changed jobs, moving to Said Business School. I had a bit of problems like getting started there. And one of the problems was that, you know, when I send out, getting set up, you know, when you change jobs, you have so many questions like equipment being delivered, how do things work, who should you reach out to? And I was just facing the situation that it took very much like a lot of difficulty to get a response to my questions, to just understand, you know, how things work and who I should reach out to. And now in the current situation, so like really, really, I applaud that within like a period of 2 weeks, we went fully remote and the school is closed, the university is closed, and everybody's remote. And the consequence of that is that I don't get all those emails anymore that usually are not directed towards me, but I'm just on some kind of list. And I think the entire organization is dealing with that amount of, well, advertising or spam. And so now when I send out an email, like this morning, I was like, oh my gosh, hour after hour, nothing comes in my inbox. And when I sent out an email, I immediately get a response. And I'm like, what happened? What is going on? So the culture of how we use email has changed from 1 week drastically to the other, which I thought was a very interesting thing as well. And it kind of leads us to the O'Leary piece that mostly talks about, you know, learning, organizational memory, information, communication.
Now, of course, this has only been a week. You know, there's certainly opportunity for the system or the culture to adapt to the new situation, which I think also ties pretty well to the O'Leary reading.
Definitely.
It's been a week at the time of recording. So by the time this comes out, if anyone's still out there, let's see how things are.
What makes me a bit worried is especially people that are like full teaching right now and have a couple of children at home. Because for them, it must be just horrid at the moment. Because I read on LinkedIn, like, someone making a joke that poor teachers that now have to give tech support to eight-year-olds because they're trying to teach them remotely.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the big risks is health and well-being. And one thing I'd like to point out, studying remote work is one of the big policy hiatuses in Europe, at least, is that all the regulation on health at work counts if you're at work or going to work. So if something happens like burnout or whatnot, as we're working from home, we're not protected by any of the regulations. There is none. And I think, you know, like, this is actually an opportunity, as a lot of freelancers work from home and they are not protected by any of the regulations we usually enjoy, to really make some progress here at the European and maybe at the global level, to really rethink, like, okay, what needs to be in place as work is changing? Because on the one hand, we now see a lot of people at risk as they have to juggle teaching their kids, doing their work, kind of having a system in place, as well as maybe enjoying the shift of balance, not having to go to work, being in traffic jam for 1.5 hour to be there, and seeing, like, okay, maybe this new way of integrating work in my life is something that I would like to extend after having to self-isolate.
All right, so let's move into the articles proper, and you know, send our listeners good vibes and stay safe and don't be stupid. Don't come out unless you have to. Let's see what organizations in the pre-internet and indeed pre-telephone time did to work over spatial and temporal boundaries. And we have two papers today. We have the Michael O'Leary, Wanda Arlikowski, and John Yates piece on distributed work over the centuries, trust and control in the Hudson's Bay Company, 1670 to 1826. And then complementing that, we have a paper by Paul Hackett, Averting Disaster, the Hudson's Bay Company and Smallpox in Western Canada during the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And on top of that, of course, we will reflect on our current experiences, and we have Greta with us today, who is, as she just mentioned, studies this stuff for a living. So that's fantastic. And who would like to introduce the papers for today?
I could have a go on the O'Leary piece. Well, basically, we're going to talk about the case of the Hudson's Bay Company, or HBC, as most of us know this company. This is a centuries-old company that started its operations in the 1670s, and from its start was a fully remote, distributed organization. In the O'Leary, Arlikowski, and Yates book chapter, actually, they focus on the role of trust and control in remote work, and they kind of point out how trust is critical in remote work, as it is impossible to monitor and control remote employees as you would do when they would be working on site. I think to understand, like, why is this an interesting case that we focus on it? Because it's the case that both the two pieces we'll be discussing today are focusing on. It's good to know a bit about its background. HPC, as I said, was established in the 1670s as a highly dispersed organization. Its headquarters was in London. Operations were thousands of miles away overseas in what we now call Canada. And it was engaging in the fur trade. So it traded furs along the shores of, well, surprise, surprise, the Hudson Bay, as well as the James Bay. Basically, the operations were financed and coordinated by a group of merchants in London. And the trade posts were in Canada. And they kind of traded European goods, like guns, knives, blankets, other goods, in exchange for furs that were trapped by Native Americans. And subsequently, these furs were shipped and auctioned in England, for instance, for the garment industry. So what you see is that while the headquarters was based in London, actually in this company, 99% of the employees were overseas. And so I think it's a very, very interesting case how being from the start, being a fully distributed organization, how you can survive so long and become so successful. As I said, HPC still operates today. It's one of the longest continually operating companies in Northern America, and it's one of the largest retailers in Canada nowadays. So let's discuss where the paper is actually about. So it's a historical analysis of this company and of its operations, and that was possible because a lot of detailed reports of its operations are still available for scholars to access and analyze. And the authors take the angle of control and trust, and they look at what practices the kind of the leaders or the management developed to make sure everything was operating. Well, they didn't have access to any of the digital technologies today, and actually communication was confined to one moment a year between the headquarters and its employees in Canada, which was in August, when the bay actually was not frozen and the ships could come in and out. So what you saw was that in August, the reports from all the trade posts in what we now call Canada were being shipped together with the furs to the headquarters. And meanwhile, the headquarters also shipped its information back to Canada with instructions of how to run the company.
Yeah, now the paper sets up kind of a dichotomy between trust and control that's often found in the current discourse. We just see a lot of discussions, and we've even had some of this discussion in previous episodes about how trust and control seem to be, I don't want to say mutually exclusive, but it seems like if you favor the or things that you would do that would promote trust, a greater trust in the organization, would seem to involve losing control or forfeiting control. And we sort of see it as an either or. Whereas the authors here are using this case as an example of where trust and control are fully interdependent. I mean, it's not either or. You can exercise control by providing greater trust. And conversely, you can encourage greater trust through the proper application of control. So it's not an either or. That's a theme that's consistent with some of the things we've been discussing in the podcast, and also consistent with some of the things we've been trying to do in, say, my organization, where we have a mission command, which is supposed to be a measured balance between trust and control. We perhaps don't define it as elegantly as they put it in this paper, but it's the same idea of how do you ensure that, you know, you give autonomy or you give responsibilities to subordinates, while at the same time trusting that they would be able to come through, and yet also ensure that the total organization operates as a whole. So, trust and control can't be at odds.
I thought that it's a weird, almost false dichotomy, to be honest, that to begin with, that trust and control are the polar opposites, and then you navigate between them, in the way that they describe, essentially, that, trust and control is actually a sort of an iterative dance, but even out of the initial definitions of the paper, this comes out a bit simplistic. And I understand that you need to frame, and intuitively it seems like trust and control is a dichotomy, but maybe, I don't know, hope and control would actually be a better one. But the way they position it is that, you know, degree of trust effectively is a function of risk involved, and trust needs to be well-grounded, as in when someone is trustworthy. And the reason why I say that it's a questionable dichotomy to even begin the analysis with, while appreciating good framing device, is that more control means less risk, which means more trust, and then more trust means less risk, so less control, and then you just essentially go as the pendulum back and forth, or oscillating between the two. It's almost like a breathing dynamic in organization, and it's not one or the other, as they do eventually show, but they also start with this version of framing their question, which is a bit odd, I suppose. There isn't an organization that is purely trust without control and the other way around. It's just not how it works, right? Or do you not agree?
I hear you, Dimitris. And, you know, as I was reflecting upon the paper, drinking my tea afterwards, I was thinking, you know, like, wherever they put control, you could put accountability. And for me, that made more sense. Like, when you have greater trust in someone to operate independently, they also have to be accountable for what they do and take the purpose and mission of the organization at heart and behaving in its best interest. That, I think, was what the paper was about. But no, letting go of, you know, what theoretical concepts they used, and maybe even adding to Dimitris about, was this paper actually about distributed work, or is it about leading at a distance? And I think it's about leading at a distance. And that's where I think this is a highly interesting case, as many companies now are like, how the heck are we going to lead our companies and make our strategic plans happen as everybody is remote? And, you know, in this case, this was an extreme case of leading at a distance, because, you know, only once a year they were communicating from a distance, but it was highly successful company. Like, I do think this element of trust, the element of empowerment, the element of culture and accountability were key in how they managed year after year build up the company. And now when you think, like, if you lead at a distance, let's start from that thought experiment, like, what did the leaders in the London headquarters do actually? Like, you know, how did they sell to their investors to invest in the company when you can only once a year know what it's actually doing?
Isn't one of the reasons, like, simply that fur trading is very lucrative, and they had, sort of say, the monopoly on that? And so, like, from the business side, that's a pretty good position to be in. So, like, also the other way around, like, what, how much would you have to mess up to actually mess this up if you have this monopoly?
I mean, there's also the thing that that was not an uncommon way of conducting business at the time. So we're looking at it through our lens, where we have instant connectivity. And I was thinking about what would be an analogous organizational situation today. And aside from some very remote mining operations and stuff like that, I couldn't really think of anything that would even approach the scale that this company or the India trading companies, East and West, both British and Dutch, were dealing with. Like, for us, I think thinking forward, you know, if we do get across to space exploration at some point, it will be similar to this, that, you know, you send out a delegate, and then it just takes really, really long time to do anything, and then you have this autonomy and coming in similarly to what's here. But nowadays we just don't see it that way, so it seems a bit odd and bizarre to have an organizational structure such as this. And I would even argue that the Hudson Bay Company, at in this form as presented to us in this article, is not really one organization in a sense that we think of organizations. I would argue that it's more resembling an association or a confederation of sorts.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Which raises its own questions and interesting issues to look at. But yeah, absolutely. Like this degree of leading or managing even at a distance, because also need to remember that the nature of work that they were involved with is not that complex, right? It's basically a distribution network. So they didn't need to deal with innovation in any radical sense of the word. The competition did come into the picture eventually, but I mean, it's not like competing for different product innovation with the same characteristics that we have now that Greta would be able to speak to way better than I would, where you have technologies overturning industries and that kind of stuff. It's just securing supply of fur and then shipping it off to London as soon as you can. It's, you know, same was happening with tea, same was happening with slaves. It's a fairly established business model at the time. And I think we need to consider this context when we discuss the degree of distribution and distance in this case.
Very good point, Demetris. And yeah, like, I think this is definitely a case of when you think about supply chain and logistics, this is what they were experts in. And, you know, the authors point out that, you know, like, if you think, okay, what was the size of this company? What territory did they cover in Northern America or nowadays Canada? And they pointed out it was size bigger than the Roman Empire at its highest point. So it was quite substantial. And coming back to that question, like, what sort of company nowadays has equal operational challenges? Well, you know, where I think of is, you know, maybe these are more companies like the government or the army or the police, intelligence. You know, the type of work that they do and their objectives are different, but in terms of scale, the territory that they cover is kind of similar, right?
I thought that whole Roman Empire span was a really cheeky rhetorical device, to be honest, because it's not the size or distance that is a challenge when it comes to managing such organizations. It's the information volume. So in crude terms, we're talking population, and I don't think Canada, you know, in the 18th century comes anywhere close to population of Roman Empire at its height. And hence, you know, you're dealing with far less information to begin with. It's pretty simple to be honest, the things that they had to deal with. The Roman Empire at one point in the 3rd century had 4 emperors that would run the whole place, the tetrarchy that was instituted by Diocletian. And even that wasn't enough because of the amount of territory, but mainly information that had to be processed. They're just chilling up north in Canada, maybe a couple of hundred people. Well, more than that, obviously, but, you know, nothing substantial and fairly simple line of communication in terms of the complexity of what is being communicated. Maybe that's one of the secret ingredients that made this possible for so long. It's reducing complexity of information coupled with granting autonomy to managers on the ground.
So that's why, like, reading through the article, that's of course my lens then, the organizational design aspect, like, I wonder to what degree people in London actually consciously thought about, okay, how are we going to deal with all these various situations? Like, was that sort of, say, conscious design choices? Was that just, well, let's see what works, and in hindsight we will find out what doesn't work? So I like to see this leadership angle, but at the same time, it's kind of like, it's like non-leadership in the sense of, there's like in, I think in German, it's like mission tactics, so to say, like the sense that we realize that the situation will always be different than what we think in London. So we have to give you some leeway about how to deal with this. But even in that situation, you can design it in that sense that you allow people, these are the things where you have freedom to make your choices. And these are the things where we need you to adhere to it. Namely, this is what we need as a letter. This is what we need from you as documents, etc. So I don't know. It's not just about volume of data, but it's also about how to set up your organization in a way that you can cope with a lot of difficult situations where you can't expect an answer from London within the next month, half year, or even year.
But what would be the alternative choice? How else would you set something like that up without information communication technologies of even, you know, telegraph caliber? Like, if we jumped into a time machine and went back to the 17th century, peculiarly dressed, granted, what would be our choice to set this up?
Well, I'm not sure if it was actually a choice. I think it's way more emergent, as the authors also acknowledge in the discussion at the end of the paper, and kind of just what happened. And, you know, that's when you do an historical analysis. This is what you can do. You can just map out what happened. And you don't know if this was all a conscious choice. But as we do now, we can reflect upon it. Like, you know, what is it that we can learn from it? Because it's pretty impressive. I know, Dimitris, you're a little underwhelmed by the whole case. But, you know,
That's not what I was trying to come across as. I'm just saying that, you know, there's more environmental factors there to consider.
Definitely.
I'm very, very impressed by companies like this.
Gotcha.
So don't get me wrong.
So how about, like, in the paper, they discuss these various organizational practices that they, and I found it, I love to read about it, like, you know, canoeing around and, you know, so they make this distinction between socialization practices, communication practices, and participation. And they kind of talk about, you know, how did they establish the culture? Like, it was a very family-like atmosphere. How did they select their employees? Who did they point out? Then they talk about, you know, the detailed written communication and the norms they established, like how to report. I thought, you know, like, I did my dissertation research in a Japanese multinational. I was like, you know, you're just writing down exactly the same, like, these practices are still alive today. And then they have, like, these very interesting leadership practices, such as, yeah, being there, I already mentioned, the canoeing around, and staying on. What are your thoughts about it? What did you like, and what didn't you like, or what were you missing?
Well, it was fascinating to see the whole section on leadership by canoeing around, because we have a equivalent phrase that we use now, which is leadership by walking around. I mean, the whole idea about the leader having to have the leader, as in the number one in a organization or sub-organization, having the personal vision of what the situation on the ground is something that we take very, very seriously. It's deeply embedded in our culture. And the whole idea that, you know, you wouldn't have the leader going around, or, you know, that the leader would stay at the headquarters, is just kind of anathema to the way that we think. Obviously, because of the restrictions of travel going back to London, you don't have the same ability to say have that leader go back to London and engage with them and say, this is what the situation is on the ground. You're not relying exclusively on the letter itself. But it was also interesting to hear the instances in which folks in Canada were telling the folks in London, hey, you do not understand the situation here. Our rivers freeze. you get the idea out of your head about I forget the exact wording, but it was the picture of the stevedore in fancy clothes on a beautiful riverbank. It's just not the same. And so in addition to the, you know, the letters, it's also the idea of situational awareness and the importance of, you know, the importance of keeping the higher headquarters understanding of what the situation is on the ground, the importance of the local leaders having that situational awareness on the ground, which requires getting out there, getting out of the trading post, and then also being able to just trust that because we don't have situational awareness, we have to trust who's out there on the front line and take their position first, while still using these accountability measures to as a check and balance, so that we can understand, you know, our stakeholders and who we have to respond to.
I couldn't have put it better, Tom. And that's where I think that accountability was like a key concept, and instead of control, because it was actually autonomy that they gave the local leaders, like the people leading the trade posts, they had a lot of autonomy how to operate, and they had to. That was the only way they could. And that is what I found striking. And I have a nice story about canoeing around. And you said, like, we have something managing by walking around. Multinationals, I think up to, like, maybe up till 2015, we have, like, this culture of managing by flying around, you know, going to all your subsidiaries. And as I discussed in another podcast I did, I talked a bit about how I did my ethnography of a Silicon Valley tech company, where I both did my ethnography online and offline at the same time. One of the things that I did, like when I entered the organization, one practice within the company that made my ethnography very, very doable was that everybody opened up their calendars. So we had a system and you could type in a person's name and you could see in what meetings they were. And this was how very easily, like, I followed several projects at the same time and I could trace, like, what meetings were happening. And by a click, like we clicked on Zoom now to have our podcast recording as kind of an improv for the technical difficulties we face today, I was in that meeting just as I am here now. And it was not only me who did that, but it was the leadership that did the same. And it was a common leadership. It was maybe leading by popping into virtual meetings, especially on the engineering side. You really want to be hands-on if all your teams are kind of in sync with what they're working on. And the leadership sometimes just popped into a meeting and heard what the conversations were about. And then later you saw them popping into another meeting. In that sense, like, digital technology made this much easier. And maybe as we're all going remote now, we can learn something there. For instance, I was thinking about how my university, and I guess many others, adopted the Microsoft software package, Office 365. And it doesn't allow you to see other people's calendars. It's a very closed, and maybe we don't want to see each other's calendars. So now as we go remote, we don't know what everyone is doing because we cannot manage by walking around.
One of the challenges with leadership by flying around too is, like, there's always going to be a tension whenever we switch, say, from increased remote operations to increased emphasis on face-to-face. Because obviously in a distributed organization, since we have the opportunity and we have had the transportation ability to bring people together, you know, there's a lot of factors that come into how much is enough. So, for example, if we decide that at the central headquarters, we don't have the face-to-face or situational awareness that we feel like we should, or we don't think that the remote communications with leaders is sufficient, then we'll start increasing face-to-face requirements and say, you all need to come to the big headquarters and let's have a face-to-face, you know, let's get everybody around the table and make sure we all have the common information. Until we discover that that's too expensive, it gets a little bit too complicated, it's too disruptive to what the leaders at the remote locations want to do. And so then the cycle, you know, the pendulum swings back to the other direction and we're going to rely more on video teleconference. All of that pendulum swing brings along its own inefficiencies, doesn't it? In a way, it's sort of refreshing to think about looking at a situation where there was no choice, where you really were stuck and you had to do everything with a simple single communication structure and try to accomplish, you know, passing information, understanding the situation. The other thing I'll point out is that the paper did a really good job about talking about how the communication norms, those communication channels evolved as things occurred. I love the story about the time that one trading post got burned down at a Christmas revelry. It was hilarious.
I agree. Yeah.
But think about,
you calling it Christmas revelry is hilarious.
Yeah, but you think about, you know, what happened. How did London got into Canada's knickers, if you will. I mean, they really started to demand more information, more accountability until the trust was reestablished. And that was, I mean, it's just interesting that that was exactly what happened. It's very common in the way that we do response to errors nowadays, you know, put the hammer down. And then over time, as trust is reestablished, we back off and try to get back to the way things were when it was all working properly.
So one of the other things that struck me, and I'd love to get your take on, guys, is, you know, something the authors described in detail but didn't really reflect upon in the discussion, and that is about employment relations, recruitment, and staying on. What you saw was that in terms of recruitment, they recruited specific people. First, they started recruiting in London, and then they realized that the people from London were not really equipped or adept at surviving in these rural settings. So they started to recruit people in, I think it was Upper Scotland or something. And also they focused on specific people. Often they recruited family, or they recruited people where they had a shared connection with. They were often orphans or people with little familial ties at home, and that were able to stay on for a longer time. Like employment contracts were 3 to 5 years, I think, in the beginning. But what you saw that a lot of the people in leadership positions stayed on up till their retirement. They offered pensions, they offered other retirement benefits, and as we will discuss later, also healthcare. Just thinking about, you know, for instance, here in the UK, we've had massive strike action happening in the past couple of weeks before Corona broke out, about how 80% of academic staff in the UK is on precarious or some form of fixed contract rather than permanent. Then thinking about, okay, what were the conditions and what were the relationships among people, that how they felt they were connected with each other, that enabled to make this whole organizational apparatus work? I guess that's my question.
I got very excited when I read about that part, because it highlighted a couple of things. One to do with control. So we were talking just some minutes ago that, you know, it's a lot to do with autonomy and trust, and maybe not as much explicit control, which, yeah, but also let's not get too crazy. We can see elements of normative control all over the place, to do both with communication norms and, as you just pointed out, Greta, recruitment philosophies and strategies. But that's not what got me excited. What got me excited is that I couldn't stop seeing holographic organizational design after this part. So the organizational design that is effectively like a cell structure, as some less than legal less than legal organizations use, like, you know, terrorist cells, also popular corporate design in the 90s and I think 80s, effectively where you have independent units structured around philosophies and ideals of the mother unit, and then you set them free and they essentially work for the benefit of the organization, but independently using the aligned system of values and ideas. Kenneth McKenzie popularized this, and I think Gareth Morgan in The Images of Organization mentioned as well, that we discussed in episode 41. So this recruitment of Scots from far north islands, the people who would not be unaccustomed to working in isolation, and people who are tied together by familial ties with existing workforce, but are otherwise, you know, usually single and effectively have nowhere else to turn, but to put it bluntly, I thought that's great. That's such an indication of normative control that the company would exercise in one of the arguably few levers of control that they had available to them, and that they made it an explicit HR strategy, if you will. I thought that was extremely interesting. It's almost like applying a form of social eugenics to your workforce selection. And beyond that, it's also a really cool indication of contingency theory, that you take the environment that you operate in, which for them were remote places with effectively no social hours, in the middle of the forest, on a bank of some frozen river, and you understand what are the environmental demands on your operations, and then you try to match the workforce to that instead of doing it the other way around or not doing it at all as they started off with. And so looking for the people who would fit into this environment and then getting them to work for the company. That was on behalf of the corporate leadership in London, I think, key to making this work as well and possibly as long as it did. I thought that was brilliant.
In line with this, what I wonder is, so like from a design perspective, like kind of like one of the difference like between an engineering approach and a design approach is that an engineer, like it's kind of like assumed that I'm building a bridge, and based on a design that kind of already is there, you just break down what you need to do and then you work it all up, etc. Well, the design approach would be much more looking holistically, and as you learn, so to say, about one part of the business, that you realize, oh wait, if this isn't working, maybe we need to also change this other part. And that's what I kind of wonder about, how, like, from London with so little knowledge about the actual circumstances, that they did try to kind of like have this holistic lens on the organization. I guess that is very important. But like, how do you do that if you realize that you need to give your employees so much leeway? If you realize that your communication is limited, so like you can't really control as directly how they do things. So how do you make sure that the different parts of the organization still, so to say, fit together with whatever goal you have as organization? I think that's the question, yes.
A quick note. The podcast episode Greta was referring to at about the 35-minute mark was titled Studying Online and Offline Work, released in June 2019 as episode 5 from the Ethnography Atelier podcast, part of the Talking About Organizations network. A link is available on our webpage.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. You may not know this, but we really love receiving feedback from our listeners. So if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some of the best people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Karamustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Peaks Kraft, Timothy Paul, Willy Lechton Wirta, and Gabriel Van Bunnen. And I apologize if I mispronounced your name. You are still the best and we love you so much. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website where a donations button will greet you. You can't miss it. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time for part 2 of the episode here on Talking About Organizations.